This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. Colonialism and imperialism do violence to the colonized. That sounds obvious, and it is, but does colonialism also harm the colonizer? Does it degrade the colonizing powers themselves? This is not an academic question. While traditional forms of colonialism may now be out of vogue, newer, often subtler forms of colonization are emerging. M.A. Césaire wrote radical political texts during the Great Age of Decolonization, when nations in Africa, Asia, and Latin America rose up against their colonial masters during the long decade that Malcolm X called the tidal wave of color. Césaire was born in 1913 on the Caribbean island of Martinique, then a French colony. One of his most forceful political texts was Discourse on Colonialism, a book that challenged habits of thinking that underpinned colonial violence. The book also connected colonialism with fascism. UCLA professor and acclaimed writer Robin D.G. Kelly has studied M.A. Césaire's work in detail. A dozen years ago, he wrote a piece about Césaire for the journal Monthly Review that still sticks with me today. In fact, when Robin Kelly visited Berkeley last week, he agreed to join me in studio to talk about Césaire's ideas and their relevance for political struggle today. Robin Kelly is professor of U.S. history at UCLA and the author of books like Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original, and Hammer and Hoe, Alabama Communists During the Great Depression. Robin began with these comments on the importance of M.A. Césaire.
Césaire, besides being one of the great 20th century poets in any culture or civilization, he's someone who both lived through and thought a lot about the relationship between colonialism, modernity, and race. He put all those things into play. And so here's someone who is a student in the 1930s, along with Leopold Senghor and Leon Damas, invented negritude. Negritude as a kind of refusal to accept modern racial hierarchy that subordinates, you know, non-white people. It's not just about being black, though it's that too, a celebration of African heritage, a heritage that had been dismissed as primitive. So it's in the 1930s, when fascism is emerging, that negritude comes into being. And it is at the end of World War II, with ideas fomented during the war, where his discourse on colonialism really comes into fruition. This is important because part of what he represents is perhaps the clearest voice among a community of thinkers who try to make sense of the horrors of fascism and to put fascism, the rise of the Nazi regime, in the context of a longer trajectory of colonial domination. So, of course, with Césaire, his breakthrough, much like Du Bois' breakthrough, later Fanon's breakthrough, and Oliver Cox and others, is to say, look, as horrible as fascism was, as genocidal as it was, all those practices of violence and genocide had already been implemented in the colonies against the Arabs, against the Africans, against the so-called coolies, the South Asians, against the whole world outside of Europe. And what makes fascism so horrific to Europeans is the fact that those tools have been applied to other Europeans. And so that, in some ways, raises a number of questions about, again, the relationship between modernity, civilization, and violence and subjugation. You know, because in some ways, you think about what Césaire was trying to achieve. He wasn't simply trying to kind of overturn the kind of, you know, colonial discourse, but rather raise a question of the interdependence of colonial domination, the way it decivilizes the civilizer and the oppressed, the way that colonialism itself is inbred, deeply embedded in modernity, in the Enlightenment project. So he's saying, I don't want your Enlightenment. Let's build a new one.
And Césaire argued that Europe is dependent on the Third World. Dependent on the Third World for what?
Well, there are many ways to think about this. One is, in very material terms, I mean, European wealth in some ways is a product of slavery, the exploitation of raw materials, cheap labor that's produced by a relationship, you know. So there's a material factor, but there's also a kind of ideological factor, and that is, like, almost everyone of Césaire's generation who were, you know, radical and black, they were all reading Hegel. Hegel may be the most important. Hegel may be more important than Marx, you know, in some ways. And using the Hegelian dialectic, they're saying that the European identity, the identity as a superior race, depends on having an inferior interdependent presence, a project, a body. Now, the sad thing about this critique is that the vast majority of Europeans, as white as they might want to be, can never really fully enjoy the benefits of that kind of master-slave dialectic, because you're also talking about using that dependence on the third world, that dependence on colonized subjects, as a way to subjugate other European workers, you know? And that was something I think he recognized, and that's why by the end of Discourse, in fact, at the beginning, he basically says you have these two things at play. One is anti-colonialism, the other is proletarian revolution, and that they're two sides of the same coin.
And Robin's referring to Césaire's book, Discourse on Colonialism, published in 1950. Tell us about the kind of revolutionary moment, the time at which, during which Césaire's book came out. What was happening in the African world and in other colonized places that made, that created a certain kind of electricity in the air that Césaire's book contributed to?
Well, the timing is fantastic when you think about it, because first of all, you have just a couple of years earlier, you have the formation of the United Nations, and in 1948, the, you know, Declaration of Human Rights. With the United Nations, the opening for the voices of former colonies achieving their independence, you know, in some cases in Asia, places like Malaysia, in Burma, India, are now speaking to the colonial powers, maybe not on an equal footing, but at least, you know, theoretically, the United Nations becomes a space to critique both U.S. and European domination and the contradictions in the racial policies. And so that's really, really important. The other thing that's important about this period is that it's clear that the European empires have collapsed. Fascism did them in. The war did it in. So Britain inevitably will have to release its colonies, and people know that. So the opposition within Africa and the Caribbean and elsewhere is rising. France will have to release its colonies. So the opposition within Africa, Asia, like Indochina, for example, it's bubbling up. And so you begin to see wars of independence. You begin to see solidarity among these emerging nationalist movements and nations. 5 years after Discourse, you have the Bandung Conference of Non-Aligned Nations. The other thing that happens is that the United States and the Soviet Union emerged as the major powers. And as a result of that, part of the question that Césaire and other intellectuals are trying to raise is, what will be their relationship to this new social order? What is their relationship to the United States? What is their relationship to the Soviet Union? What is the path ahead? And the amazing thing that we sometimes forget or play down is that as strong as capitalism was at the end of World War II, as strong as the Marshall Plan and massive reinvestment and, you know, jobs programs might have been, the fact is it was after World War II that the real competition between capitalism and socialism takes off. The Cold War wasn't just about a power play. It was an ideological battle, a battle over ideas. And so in 1950, socialism as a possible path was legitimate. If it wasn't, you wouldn't have to have a Cold War, you know? Uh-huh. And this is significant because in some ways, Césaire stood at a particular moment when people of the so-called third world, which is being sort of invented, are debating what path to take and, you know, whether or not there's a path that's non-capitalist but non-Soviet. And finally, Césaire is in a fairly difficult position. As some listeners may know, he didn't plan to go into politics at all. He wanted to be a poet. He wanted to be a writer, a critic, a playwright. And, you know, he was persuaded to run for the French National Assembly under the Communist Party ticket. And he eventually became mayor of Fort-de-France in Martinique. But he made a kind of crucial and some say tragic political decision to support an association with the French Empire as opposed to complete independence. And that association kept Martinique in some ways dependent. And, you know, why he made that decision is, you know, was up to debate. But the fact of the matter is that by standing in this moment of multiple paths forward, politically he chose a path that actually contradicted even his own writings, you know.
Right. Martinique was a French colony, and he advocated when he became a legislator that Martinique be made a department of France. Is that correct?
Right, exactly.
And in fact, it was made a department. And what was Césaire's reaction to that? Was he pleased with the result of that?
He was struggling with a number of things. I mean, he's someone who studied history, and he's someone who was fascinated with Haiti. I mean, Haiti was, in some ways, a model for him. Haiti was a place that he considered the first place in the Western Hemisphere where, as he puts it, kind of the black man ruled. You know, he was also had a diplomatic relationship to Haiti as well, as a kind of an ambassador early on. But he chose to side with Toussaint, and Toussaint historically wanted to have that kind of departmentalization. He wanted to have that kind of association with France.
Hmm.
Why? Not because Toussaint loved France. It was because Toussaint did not think that Haiti could exist in a world economy and succeed independently without that relationship. And so I think these are the kinds of issues that Césaire was struggling with. You know, there's a parallel, and that is Sékou Touré in Guinea, West Africa, was also part of the Mali Federation, which was an effort to maintain that departmentalization association with France. But it was Sékou Touré at Guinea who decided, I'm going to break totally. And what was the consequence? The consequence is not only did France cut him off immediately, but the cutoff had tragic economic consequences. He turned to Soviet Union for support, and it led to a kind of downward spiral. And so in some ways, even though this happens later, I think that Césaire witnessed all this. He anticipated this problem. He was never comfortable or happy with, I think, the final outcome of departmentalization. And I think that he expressed his discomfort and outrage, or disappointment, I should say, in his later writings. So by the time he's writing in the 1960s, I think it's Océan en Congo, and his The Tragedy of Christophe, I think it is, and in his book on Toussaint, he actually goes over these steps, you know, historically in other places, and calls for more revolutionary activity, calls for armed struggle, calls for, you know, certain kinds of independence, despite the fact that his own politics didn't sort of express that.
Can you talk more about what Césaire thought was the impact on the colonizer of colonization and how that might compare with Frantz Fanon's formulation in his classic Wretched of the Earth? This was published 11 years later in 1961. How did the two thinkers differ? How were their views similar on this issue of, you know, who was the real barbarian?
I think that what Césaire was trying to say when he says that colonialism decivilizes the civilizer, that the only way they can maintain the kind of domination, both psychological, physical, economic, social, is through a kind of violence that didn't border on barbarism, it was barbarism. And you cannot be barbaric whether you're using the most sophisticated tools of the state or just a bludgeon. You can't act in a barbaric way without becoming barbaric yourself. And so for him, it's like fascism was the chickens coming home to roost. It was almost inevitable that eventually that violence would be turned inward. Of course, the question of what's inwards, interesting, because, you know, the fact that Europe never constituted a whole. In fact, the wholeness of Europe as an identity is very much a product of that colonial relationship. You know, without the colonial relationship, you wouldn't even think about Europe as a place or Europeans as a people. Mm. And I think that's interesting. With Fanon, who was, I'd say, a student of Césaire's in many ways, Fanon was also dealing with the question of violence, not so much as a kind of inherent barbarism, but violence as a kind of act of resistance that can free or even engage in the process of decolonization of the mind and psyche. You know, so here's Fanon, psychiatrist, seeing colonial violence and the effect it has on dehumanizing the colonized. And of course, with Fanon, gender is very, very important. So with, in some ways, it is an assault on masculinity to be reduced to a kind of servile status under colonialism. So violence becomes this liberating force. It becomes a way of breaking the shackles and creating new people. And I think that's one difference. Also with Fanon, he seemed to be less concerned, and I could be wrong about this, with the kind of psyche of the colonized. Because his main thing was, look, what impact has colonialism had on these Algerian peasants? What does it mean to create a new man? And for him, for all the issues about revolutionary violence and colonial violence, Fanon was very optimistic. In fact, in some ways, you could say he's much more optimistic than Césaire, because for him, he sees the destruction of Europe. I mean, just like Césaire said, Europe is indefensible, Fanon sees the anti-colonial movement as potentially the place where the heart of kind of world civilization, the future of the world, rests with the third world. That the third world is in some ways going to invent a new humanity, you know, a new human being. Of course, he had his pessimistic side as well, because he also warned that one of the greatest threats to this new humanity, this new movement, is the petty bourgeoisie, is that kind of the class created by colonial domination that saw itself as superior, but more importantly, that had invested itself in European humanism, invested itself in the colonial order.
Like small merchants, artisans, that kind of
thing. Exactly, mm-hmm. And colonial officers, which is very important, because colonial officers in the African context, the Francophone African context, almost all of them were Caribbean. And so the Caribbean became like a conveyor belt to bring black intellectuals and put them in colonial offices in Africa itself. And for Fanon, there was hope in particular individuals like Patrice Lumumba of the Congo and in some ways Kwame Nkrumah, but he didn't have a lot of hope for that kind of middle strata. And it was a dilemma that he died not being able to resolve.
And this question of kind of the making of the new man, the making of the new human, brings to mind the issue of the revolutionary agent, right? So for many years, Césaire was a member of the Communist Party until he famously resigned in 1956. But he identified for a long time as a Marxist and as a communist. And of course, under kind of socialism communism, the revolutionary agent is the proletariat, the working class. So given that the anti-colonial struggle doesn't necessarily mean that there is a, quote, working class, a traditional working class that is rising up. In fact, it means really an entire nation of people is rising up against their colonial masters. How did Césaire resolve the issue of who would command the historical stage in terms of carrying out the revolution?
Right. Now that's an excellent question, because I guess my take on this, and I haven't decided whether or not this is right, but my take is that Césaire was never fully committed to Marxism, the Marxism of the French Communist Party. Like he was drawn to Marxism like everyone of his generation was drawn to Marxism. His being drawn to Marxism was developed in the era of fascism in the 30s. In other words, negritude was one path, but even in discussions about what negritude is, a Marxist framework was circulating. I mean, it was dominant. You know, where does that Marxist framework come from? It comes from the circle of surrealists, I think, that Césaire was surrounded by and had influenced when he had returned to Martinique, and he and his wife, Suzanne Roussy, also Suzanne Césaire, started Tropique. And you read some of those articles in Tropique, it's probably less negritude and more of a kind of neo-Marxism that pays attention to or privileges culture as the weapon, that culture transformation is the means by which revolution will take place. It's not just political economy. And I think that influenced his decision to join the French Communist Party. I mean, he was recruited to the French. He didn't join on his own. I mean, he didn't like run to the French Communist Party. He was recruited because he saw it as the only game in town. And the fact that during World War II, the communists didn't look too bad because the Soviet Union was on the right side of the war, you know. So here's, to go back to the question, I think Césaire actually saw the anti-colonial revolt and colonial subjects as the engine for revolutionary transformation, because for him, it wasn't a proletariat per se, but the fact that much of the world was proletarianized by the racial dynamics of colonialism itself. And so what you're witnessing is a different conception of who the proletariat is. And so for him, there is like the West and the rest of us, to use the phrase that Chinwezu used in his wonderful book. There's the West and there's the rest of us. The concept of the proletariat comes in by being able to parse out who the West or what the West is. That within the West, it's not a singular class, but rather a proletariat inside America and Europe that in Césaire's mind has utterly failed to take up its historic role. And that, in fact, it is a critique of Leninism, a critique of Marxism, saying that the industrial proletariat, meaning the European or American proletariat, is the engine of change. He said, no, it's coming from the third world. Now, does this make Césaire unique? Not at all. In fact, you go back and read the great Indian communist M.N. Roy, who was debating this with Lenin in 1920. You go back and read Sen Katayama, the great Japanese communist who's debating this as well. In other words, there's a whole tradition of left radicals, many of whom are outside of the European frame, trying to understand why is it that the most militant revolts are among peasants in India or among Indians in the Amazon or among workers in China, that some of these struggles are in fact at the forefront of creating this new society.
Surrealism. Well, we have to talk about surrealism if we're talking about Césaire, the poet, the critic, the essayist. And of course, you know, we could spend hours just talking about what surrealism is, right? And its different roots and manifestations in Europe and elsewhere. But maybe we can just talk about Césaire's take on surrealism. What did he do with existing notions of surrealism that you found interesting?
What I found most interesting is the way that he recognized surrealism, not as a radical break from the knowledge with which he was familiar, but rather a kind of a familiar connection to indigenous knowledge. And by indigenous knowledge, we can talk about what he grew up seeing and hearing in the Caribbean among, you know, even someone like, you know, people like sugarcane workers who had certain beliefs and notions of the spirit. What he recognized in non-Western emerging so-called third world cultures, where there's a kind of wholeness and poetry to life itself that, you know, the kind of split between the rational and the emotional was no split at all, you know, and that part of what I think for Césaire surrealism was a, not suppression, but an overcoming of the rational, to open up the mind to the imagination, to things that don't fall within the kind of Cartesian conception of the world. So with Césaire, he was a surrealist, but not so much an enthusiastic one. You know, he was more surrealist in practice, but for him, it's like, well, you know, it's what it is. It's a great story about how André Breton comes to Martinique and he wants to go to Haiti, you know. And so Césaire takes him to Haiti. And I guess Wilfredo Lam, the great artist, was there too. But the main thing is that Breton witnesses Vaudun and other kinds of rituals that for him was just too much, too outrageous, too free, and it actually disturbed him. And so, you know, people chided Breton, saying, well, you know, you want surrealism. Here is a massive excursion into the imagination, into the subconscious, with trance, with a kind of different relationship to the body. All these things are happening, and they were happening long before surrealism was named, long before there was a Surrealist Manifesto. And in fact, in order to understand the essential quality of, in some ways, Caribbean or African political movements, you got to understand the kind of surrealist character, you know. There's another side of surrealism as well, I think, and that has to do with trying to understand the reality of colonial relationships, that there's something quite, you know, on the dark side of surrealism is the side of the absurdity of daily life, where someone like Césaire can have a greater mastery of the French language than de Gaulle or any major French intellectual, and yet still be treated as somehow uncivilized, as a second-class citizen, or even the idea that assimilation is this one-way street in which becoming French and dispensing with everything you brought with you, which then is appropriated and resold to you, that how surreal is that, how absurd it is. And so these are the kinds of things he's juggling with. I never thought of Césaire, again, as an enthusiastic promoter of surrealism, despite the fact he may be one of the most important voices of modern surrealism.
A lot of people who think about revolution and kind of revolutionary politics don't spend a whole lot of time on the radical imagination and may even dismiss it as being just sort of, you know, too up in the clouds, too divorced from sort of the hard reality of organizing and mobilizing and strategizing on a concrete level on the ground, what to do and how to do it and how to get people going. What's your sense of how Aimé Césaire and the surrealists would respond to that?
Well, it's a great time to ask that question, given the Occupy movement, not just in the U.S., but across the globe, where the radical imagination is really what's behind it. The idea that you can even have a General Assembly and consensus-based democratic action, that you can redefine what direct action is, that you can redefine what nonviolence is, that you can, you know, begin through an encampment to try to create the society that you want to live in on the ground, you know, in the midst of everything that's going on. I think that is evidence that the kind of imagination that Césaire really promoted is not just possible, but necessary to move any movement to the next stage. And so I'll give you an example. Césaire thought of poetry and life as kind of the same, and that what is the poem but a kind of spewing forth of the unconscious. And when you spew forth the unconscious, all the ideas, the suppressed dreams, the suppressed forms of knowledge, poetic knowledge in particular, becomes, you know, set before you to provide alternative paths to what you know. And part of the problem with trying to organize in a pragmatic way without imagining your way forward is that you end up reproducing the same kind of system, you know, the same systems of rationality, the same systems of economy, the same systems of where mobilization is, you know, whether it's right or left, is still based on self-interest rather than even pushing towards a kind of utopic vision of the future, that you'll be stuck. Not to say that Césaire's political practice actually mirrored that, but his poetic practice and his nonfiction writings, I think, really laid the groundwork for trying to move beyond the conditions of crisis, you know? And for Césaire, the key moments in his life, I think, were all conditions of crisis. You know, fascism, World War II, post-war, Cold War, 1960s. You know, these are all moments of crisis. And yet, he continued to write and dream and imagine a different kind of possibility that went beyond colonialism and beyond humanism, but something else. If we don't have that kind of imagination, if we didn't have it, we could, I mean, even the things that have become standard practice were built around imaginative possibilities. No one ever thought, you know, living in Russia, for example, in 1905, that, you know, there'd be like state power or socialism, you know, in 1917, whatever that means for all of its problems. And, you know, and if anything, Stalinism that kind of crushed that. No one thought that a place like Grenada, living in Grenada in the 1960s, that by the 1970s you'd have something close to socialism there, a cooperative economy. So everything required that kind of level of imagination, you know.
Robin Kelly teaches American history at UCLA. His books include Hammer and Hoe, Alabama Communists During the Great Depression, and Freedom Dreams. He also co-edited the volume Imagining Home, Class, Culture, and Nationalism in the African Diaspora. And we're talking a lot this hour about Aimé Césaire, who was a Martinique-born critic and thinker and writer, born in 1913 on the Caribbean island, which was a French colony, still a French possession. And he wrote, among other texts, Discourse on Colonialism. My name is C.S. Song. What about colonialism today? A lot of people would say, well, look, you know, there really isn't anything like that anymore, in, at least in formal terms, and therefore Césaire's discourse doesn't really speak to our times. In what forms, if any, does colonialism exist today?
Yeah, I'm sure the Greeks will have a different take on this. what we used to call in the old days, it's funny to say old days, but neocolonialism, that language has kind of dropped out of favor, but it's so pertinent right now, where you have entire national economies dependent on a system of debt, IMF, World Bank loans. You think about what it means in this neoliberal age to try to sustain an economy that's based on the needs of many people, based on a very strong social safety net, based on, you know, good education, social services, decent wages. That is impossible nowadays under neoliberalism, because the kinds of global powers can force nations through austerity measures and through debt to do exactly what was being done under colonialism, and that is make entire nation susceptible to, or at least open to investment through, you know, wage controls, destroying unions, destroying social life altogether, cutting back or defunding any kind of social safety net, education, social services, replace it with a prison system or punitive systems. We saw that with Iraq, with the war in Iraq, where Paul Bremer steps in and says, well, if we're going to ever restore democracy, the first thing we need to do is change the state and basically turn Iraq into a colony of U.S. capital. And it's very clear, all the circumstances were there. You think about what's happening in Africa right now, where despite, you know, all the kind of new African Renaissance, the debt relationship, the relationship of dependency is still there. The difference is that the colonial officers now are the leaders of regimes who are friendly to World Bank and IMF and other interests, who are able to skim off the top, take a lot of money, and still maintain the conditions for foreign investment. So the colonial relationship hasn't broken. Now, what is the psychological dimensions of that? Well, what it means is that we are still dealing with, you know, a sense of national independence, but one tempered by a kind of superior inferiority complex. There's still a sense that Africa has to catch up to the West. What does that really mean? People still talk about that. People still talk about, you know, the Arab Spring, for example. And here's one of the most dynamic movements for social democracy in decades. And there's still this talk about, well, if only the Egyptians were a little bit more sophisticated, maybe they can catch up to, you know, American democracy, as if that's the model. Finally, and this is probably the most important aspect of this, Césaire talks about thingification. That is, how do you reduce human beings to things? Not just commodities, but things that could be destroyed. And the war on terror, Afghanistan, Iraq, you know, Pakistan, I mean, everywhere you turn, there's a way in which people, South Asians, people of Arab descent, people who just look like terrorists, have been thingified. When you have slogans during the first Gulf War to the effect that, with people wearing T-shirts saying, I'll travel 10,000 miles to smoke a camel, you know, meaning to murder through the dropping of bombs, Saddam Hussein's forces, you know, human beings. Not even forces, but civilians. I mean, the fact that you can talk about things like collateral damage, you know, or this beautiful term that the great playwright Naomi Wallace talks about, white phosphorus, that white phosphorus in kind of military lingo, which is this horrible chemical which burns people, they call it shake and bake. You know, the fact that you use language like shake and bake to talk about the application of white phosphorus on those who you see as enemy combatants, I mean, that is the height of thingification. Mm-hmm. And we all invest in it in the so-called West, where there's very little outcry against that because these are not human beings. You know, and then, you know, we can go on and on. We could talk about just what happens in the United States in terms of the treatment of undocumented workers, immigrants, still African Americans. Thingification is embedded in the culture, and that's one of the sites of struggle.
I want to return to Césaire's Negritude, which its impulse, I believe, and I believe you wrote this a while ago, its impulse was to recover the history of Africa's accomplishments. That was a big part of Negritude. To what extent did Césaire yearn for or call for a return to some kind of utopian African past?
Césaire, unlike some of his compatriots like Senghor and others, wasn't interested at all in returning to a pre-colonial African past. In fact, for him, Negritude was a kind of refusal to accept the racial discourse of colonialism and a recognition that, in fact, the march of civilization, as Adorno would put it, does not necessarily mean the rise from like barbarism to like sophistication, but more or less the march of society from the slingshot to the atom bomb. That in fact we can't completely invest in what he sees as European humanism, but there's another humanism, and that's a humanism born not so much in a kind of ancient African past, not so much in the kings and the princes and, you know, as much as he kind of celebrates and identifies with that, his thing is in the struggle of what it means to become human in the context of a long, long march of civilization, of African civilizations, that we see the fruits of a possible way forward. You know, for him, Negritude was a future of humanizing the globe with a different kind of humanity, different kind of humanism, but not one that is a return back. And so that's why when you think about the kind of atavistic character of Black nationalism sometimes, where people are trying to say, well, let's go back to polygamy. Let's go back to even modes of African socialism, you know, whatever that means. That wasn't Césaire's bag at all.
And finally, our discussion has touched to a great extent on sort of the great anti-colonial period, right? The period of African struggles for liberation and self-determination and independence, successful struggles in the 1950s and early 1960s. Your new book, it's called Africa Speaks, America Answers. It's due out next February from Harvard University Press. Brings that in. It relates that period of time to four musicians, two U.S.-based, one Ghanaian, and one based in South Africa. Can you tell us a little bit more about the theme of your new book?
Sure. What I wanted to do was follow the path of these four artists. Randy Weston, born in Brooklyn, Ahmed Abdul-Malik, also born in Brooklyn, and then Guy Warren, a Ghanaian drummer who made really the first African jazz fusion album in the U.S., coming to the U.S. to make it as a jazz drummer, and then the great singer, South African singer, Satima B. Benjamin. And the idea is to sort of understand each of their quests to either bring jazz to African music or Africa to jazz as a statement of an alternative modernity. Césaire is very important because in some ways he and his cohort represent the context of coming up with an anti-colonial idea that is not a return to pre-colonial Africa, but a movement towards a new modernity that does not a single modernity, and that the Europe doesn't have, or America doesn't have, a monopoly on modernity, and that jazz was seen as the avenue to do that. Sometimes it succeeded, sometimes it failed. But the main thing is that, you know, for someone like Randy Weston, he goes to West Africa in search of some roots, some origin, some ancient past. And what he discovers is a very dynamic, future-oriented, modern music that's a hybrid of Caribbean music, jazz, African music, European music. And this excites him because, in his view, it is the music of the new African nations that's the future. In someone like Ahmed Abdul-Malik, who looked to North Africa and the Middle East for that kind of fusion. Again, you know, for him, it's a sacred music. It's a music of Islam. It's a music that is hoping to restore back to a kind of rootless modernity. A rooted modernity that's tied to Islam. So each one has a different conception of modernity, but each one sees this music and the fusion of this music as a path forward.
Robin Kelly's new book, Africa Speaks, America Answers, Modern Jazz and Revolutionary Times, is due out next February. We have a link to that book as well as to his faculty page at UCLA, where he is Gary Nash Professor of American History. Thanks so much, Robin, for joining us in studio.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Erica Bridgman is at the controls. I'm C.S. Song. Robin Kelly referred to the great age of decolonization, during which dozens of African nations broke free from colonial rule. Kwame Nkrumah was a freedom fighter and pan-Africanist who became the first leader of Ghana. Here is Ghanaian President Kwame Nkrumah speaking in 1960 at the UN General Assembly.
One cardinal fact of our time is the momentous impact of Africa's awakening upon the modern world. The flowing tide of African nationalism sweeps everything before it and constitutes a challenge to the colonial powers to make a just restitution for the years of injustice and crime committed against our continent. But Africa does not seek vengeance. It is against her very nature to harbor malice. Over 2 million of our people cry out with one voice of tremendous power. And what do they say? We do not ask for death for our oppressors. We do not pronounce wishes of ill faith for our slave masters. We make an assertion of a just and positive demand. Our voice booms across the oceans and mountains, over the hills and valleys, in the desert places, and through the vast expanse of mankind's inhabitations. And it calls out for the freedom of Africa. Africa wants her freedom. Africa must be free. It is a simple call, but it's also a signal lighting a red warning to those who would tend to ignore it. For years and years, Africa has been the footstool of colonialism and imperialism, exploitation and degradation. From the north to the south, from the east to the west, her sons languished in chains of slavery and humiliation, and Africa's exploiters and self-appointed controllers of her destiny strode across the land with incredible inhumanity, without mercy, without shame, and without honor. But these days are gone, and gone forever. And now I, an African, stand before this august assembly of the United Nations and speak with the voice of peace and freedom, proclaiming to the world the dawn of a new era. Let me say here and now that our tribulations and sufferings hardened and steel us, making us a bastion of indomitable courage and fortifying our iron determination to smash our chains. I look upon the United Nations as the only organization that holds out any hope for the future of mankind. Mr. President, distinguished delegates, cast your eyes across Africa. The colonialists and imperialists are still there. In this 20th century of enlightenment, some nations still extol the vain glories of colonialism and imperialism. As long as a single foot of African soil remains under foreign domination, the world shall know no peace. The United Nations must call upon all nations that have colonies in Africa to grant complete independence to the territories still under their control. In my view, possession of colonies is now quite incompatible with membership of the United Nations. This is a new day in Africa. And as I speak now, 13 new African nations have taken their seat this year in this August Assembly as independent sovereign states. The readiness of any people to assume responsibility for governing themselves can be determined only by themselves. I would suggest that when the Charter of the United Nations comes to be revised, a permanent seat should be created for Africa on the Security Council in view not only of the growing number of African members of the United Nations, but also of the increasing importance of the African continent in world affairs. This suggestion applies equally to Asia and to the Middle East. The problem of Africa, looked as a whole, is a wide and diversified one. But its true solution lies in the application of one principle, namely, the right of a people to rule themselves. And the idea that when a handful of settlers acquire a living space on our continent, the indigenous must lose this right, is not only a serious travesty of justice, but also a woeful contradiction of the very dictates of history. Out of a total African population of over 230 million people, some 3% are of non-African origin. Mr. President and distinguished delegates, to suppose that such a small minority could in any other continent produce acute political difficulties would be unthinkable. Yet, such is the subconscious feeling of certain European settlers in Africa, that to them, the paramount issue in Africa is not the welfare of the 97%, but rather the entrenchment of the rights of the 3% of the European settlers' minorities in Africa. I believe that reasonable solution can be found to the African problem, which would not prejudice the minorities on the continent. No effective solution, however, can be found if political thinking in regard to a solution begins with the rights of the 3%. Colonialism and imperialism and racialism are doomed in Africa. And the sooner the colonial powers recognize this fact, the better it will be for them and the world.
Kwame Nkrumah, President of Ghana, giving an address in 1960 to the United Nations General Assembly. That audio, edited by yours truly, was provided by the Pacifica Radio Archives. This is Sia suggesting, as Albert Einstein once did, that the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we will look for you next time. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please check us out on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find audio of past programs, and it's a great way to sign up for our podcast. You might also look us up on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. Against the Grain Radio. Many thanks to Erica Bridgman, who's at the controls today.